This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of tendon transfer principles from the hand section on orthobullets.com. To start this review, let's go over some principles of tendon transfers as it relates to matching muscle strength. Some key concepts to keep in mind is that force is proportional to the cross-sectional area, where the greatest force of contraction exerted is when the muscle is at resting length. Another important concept is amplitude is proportional to the length of muscle, work capacity equals force times amplitude, and motor strength will decrease one grade after transfer. So ideally, you should transfer a muscle with a motor grade of 5. Other important concepts to keep in mind include appropriate tensioning and appropriate excursion. So with respect to appropriate excursion, you can adjust with the pulley or the tenodesis effect. Remember the Smith 3-5-7 rule. 3 centimeters of excursion, that corresponds to the wrist flexors and wrist extensors, 5 centimeters of excursion, which corresponds to the EDC, the FPL, and the EPL, and 7 centimeters of excursion, which corresponds to the FDS and the FDP. Some surgical priorities to keep in mind include 1. Elbow flexion, which is innervated by the musculocutaneous nerve, 2. Shoulder stabilization, which is innervated by the suprascapular nerve, 3. Brachiothoracic pinch, which is innervated by the pectoral nerve, 4. Sensation of C6 to C7, which comes from the lateral cord, and 5. Wrist extension and finger flexion, which comes from the lateral and posterior cords. As far as selection for tendon transfers, you should determine what function is missing, then determine what muscle tendon units are available, and evaluate the options for transfer. Some basic principles to keep in mind is that the donor must be expendable and of similar excursion and power. Remember that one tendon transfer performs one function. Synergistic transfers rehabilitate more easily, it is optimal to have a straight line of pull, and one grade of motor strength is lost following transfer. As far as the prognosis after a tendon transfer, age is the leading prognostic factor, and prognosis tends to be worse after age 30. As far as location of the tendon transfer, remember that distal is better than proximal. As far as the presentation of these patients, it's important to do a thorough physical exam. So in the setting of a brachial plexus injury, you may see Horner's sign, which correlates with a C8 to T1 avulsion and often appears 2 to 3 days following injury. In a brachial plexus injury, patients may have severe pain in an anesthetic limb, which is an indication of root avulsion. Patients may also exhibit loss of rhomboid function, which is also an indication of root avulsion. A radial nerve palsy is classified according to the location of the lesion proximal or distal to the origin of the PIN. So a low radial nerve palsy is a PIN syndrome, and a high radial nerve palsy manifests with loss of radial nerve proper function, that is the triceps, brachioradialis, ECRL, plus muscles innervated by the PIN. Median nerve palsy is classified according to the location of the lesion proximal or distal to the origin of the AIN. In a low median nerve palsy, you'll have loss of thumb opposition, which is secondary to abductor pollicis brevis function, and in a high median nerve palsy, you'll have loss of thumb opposition, as well as loss of thumb, index finger, and middle finger flexion. In an ulnar nerve palsy, you can have a low ulnar nerve palsy or a high ulnar nerve palsy. In a low ulnar nerve palsy, you'll have a loss of power pinch, abduction of the small finger, otherwise known as Wartenberg sign, and clawing, which results from imbalance between the intrinsic and extrinsic muscles. A high ulnar nerve palsy will manifest with loss of ring and small finger FDP function, which is the primary distinguishing deficit between a high ulnar nerve palsy and a low ulnar nerve palsy. Clawing is less pronounced in a high ulnar nerve palsy because extrinsic flexors are not functioning. As far as studies to obtain, sensory and motor evoked potentials are better than standard EMG/nerve conduction studies. As far as treatment, non-operative management includes physical therapy, splinting, and antispasticity medications. This is indicated when there is decreased passive range of motion and in the setting of spasticity. Operative options can be divided into early surgical intervention, which is defined as 3 weeks to 3 months, and late surgical intervention, which is defined as 3 to 6 months. Early surgical intervention, again 3 weeks to 3 months, is indicated for total or near total brachial plexus injury, as well as high energy injuries. A late surgical intervention, which again is defined as 3 to 6 months, is indicated for partial upper-level brachial plexus palsy and low energy injury. As far as postoperative care after late surgical intervention, you should protect the patient for 3 to 4 weeks, then begin range of motion, continue with the protective splint for 3 to 6 weeks, and finally remember that synergistic transfers are easier to rehabilitate. Synergistic actions occur together in normal function, for example, finger flexion and wrist extension. Now let's go over some specific transfers and indications. We'll talk about the goals to regain specific functions, and then the specifics as far as donor tendon and the recipient tendon. Remember, the donor tendon is the working tendon and the recipient tendon is the deficient tendon. So with the goal to regain shoulder stability in the setting of a flail shoulder secondary to axillary nerve palsy, the most appropriate option will be a glenohumeral arthrodesis. With the goal to regain elbow flexion secondary to musculocutaneous nerve palsy, you can take a donor tendon from the pectoralis major and or the latissimus dorsi, and the recipient tendon will be the biceps. With the goal to regain elbow flexion secondary to musculocutaneous nerve palsy, you can take a donor tendon from the common flexor mass, and the recipient tendon will be a point more proximal on the humerus. This is known as a Steindler flexoroplasty. With the goal to regain elbow extension secondary to radial nerve and PIN palsy, donor tendons can include the deltoid, latissimus dorsi, or biceps, and the recipient tendon is the triceps. With the goal to regain wrist extension secondary to radial nerve and PIN palsy, the donor tendon will be the pronator teres, and the recipient tendon will be the ECRB. With the goal to regain finger extension secondary to radial nerve and PIN palsy, the donor tendon can be the FDS, FCR, or FCU, and the recipient tendon will be the EDC. With the goal to regain thumb extension secondary to radial nerve and PIN palsy, the donor tendon can be the palmaris longus, or FDS, and the recipient tendon is the EPL. With the goal to regain thumb opposition and abduction secondary to a low median nerve palsy, the donor tendon can be the FDS from the ring finger, and the recipient tendon will be the base of the proximal phalanx or the APB tendon. You can use the FCU as a pulley, and this is considered the classic Bunnell opponent's plasty. Another option to regain thumb opposition and abduction secondary to low median nerve palsy is an EIP donor tendon to an APB recipient tendon. And keep in mind that with the APB, the pulley is around the ulnar side of the wrist. With the goal to regain thumb IP flexion secondary to high median nerve palsy, the donor tendon will be the brachioradialis, and the recipient tendon will be the FPL. With the goal to regain index and long finger flexion, the donor tendon can be the FDP of the ring and small finger, which is innervated by the ulnar nerve, and the recipient tendon will be the FDP of the index and middle fingers, which will be a side-to-side transfer. With the goal to regain thumb adduction secondary to ulnar nerve palsy, the donor tendons can be the FDS or ECRB, and the recipient tendon can be the adductor pollicis. With the goal to regain finger abduction, with the index being the most important, donor tendons can be the APL, the ECRL, or the EIP. The recipient tendon is the first dorsal interosseous. Finally, in the setting of a reverse clawing effect secondary to ulnar nerve palsy, donor tendons can be the FDS or ECRL. However, keep in mind that you must pass volar to the transverse metacarpal ligament to flex the proximal phalanx. The recipient tendon in this setting will be the lateral bands of the ulnar digits. The major complications to mention include adhesions, and these cases necessitate aggressive therapy and possible secondary tenolysis. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads, which of the following is the most consistently proposed tendon transfer for radial nerve palsy? And the choices are 1, pronator teres to extensor carpi radialis brevis, 2, brachioradialis to extensor carpi radialis brevis, 3, flexor carpi radialis to extensor digitorum communis, 4, palmaris longus to extensor pollicis longus, 5, flexor digitorum superficialis to abductor pollicis longus and extensor pollicis brevis. The correct answer to this question is 1. Pronator teres to extensor carpi radialis brevis. So whereas there are many variations of tendon transfers for radial nerve palsy, the most consistently proposed tendon transfer is the pronator teres to extensor carpi radialis brevis. The brachioradialis is innervated by the radial nerve, so that is not an option. The flexor digitorum superficialis, flexor carpi radialis, and flexor carpi ulnaris are appropriate options to transfer to the extensor digitorum communis. The palmaris longus is not always present. A transfer to the abductor pollicis longus and extensor pollicis brevis may not be necessary if the extensor pollicis longus is rerouted to allow for abduction of the first ray. Moving on to the next question. A 47-year-old woman sustained a non-displaced distal radius fracture 6 months ago and is unable to extend her thumb. When performing reconstruction using the extensor indices proprius to the extensor pollicis longus transfer, tension is ideally determined by securing the tendons in what manner? And the choices are 1. In maximum tension with the wrist and thumb in extension. 2. In maximum tension with the wrist and thumb in neutral. 3. In maximum tension with the wrist and thumb in flexion. 4. According to the tenodesis effect with the wrist flexion and extension. And 5. According to functional testing with the patient awake under local anesthesia. The correct answer to this question is 5, according to functional testing with the patient awake under local anesthesia. So extensor pollicis longus rupture can result from distal radius fractures. Synergistic tendon transfer can be achieved using the extensor pollicis longus as the motor donor. Whereas different schemes for achieving optimal tension are available, the most reliable method is to tension the repair under local anesthesia while asking the patient to perform thumb flexion and extension. Tendon transfer tension can be adjusted accordingly to achieve maximum extension without compromising active flexion range. Other methods of tensioning are estimates at best, and maximum tensioning in patients without neuromuscular disease is rarely used in tendon transfers. Moving on to the next question. A 20-year-old woman sustained a laceration to her volar forearm 4 centimeters proximal to the wrist flexion crease. She has numbness in the thumb, index, and middle fingers. After microscopic repair of the median nerve, 2 weeks of splinting, and commencement of a hand therapy program, the patient is most likely to require what secondary operation 6 months after the injury? And the choices are 1. Tenolysis of the profundus tendons at the wrist. 2. Nerve transfer of the ulnar motor nerve to the median motor nerve. 3. Opponentsplasty with the extensor indices. 4. Open carpal tunnel release. And 5. Transfer of the extensor digiti minimi to the first dorsal interosseous tendon. The correct answer to this question is 3. Opponentsplasty with the extensor indices. So the patient sustained a laceration of the median nerve in what would be considered a low median nerve injury. Standard treatment entails exploration and microscopic repair of the median nerve. With a good quality nerve repair in a young adult, return of some sensory function, albeit reduced compared with the normal nerve, is usual. Return of motor function to the thenar muscles is more unpredictable. If the patient begins a therapy program within a few weeks after nerve repair, it is unlikely that tenolysis of the profundus tendons would be required. An open carpal tunnel release would be unlikely to change functional return. The patient would not be expected to have lost first dorsal interosseous function after a median nerve laceration because this muscle is innervated by the ulnar nerve. A neurotization procedure for low median nerve palsy has been described, but it consists of transfer of the distal anterior interosseous nerve into the median nerve motor fascicles, not transfer of the ulnar nerve. Therefore, the most likely secondary procedure required in this scenario is an opponentsplasty procedure to improve thumb opposition. And moving on to the final question, which of the following conditions precludes performing a tendon transfer? And the choices are 1. The target joint has a full passive range of motion. 2. The range of motion of the target joint only occurs in the direction of correction. 3. The target joint cannot be passively corrected to its neutral position. 4. The muscle to be transferred is out of phase. And 5. There is no pulley to assist the transferred muscle's fulcrum. The correct answer to this question is 3. The target joint cannot be passively corrected to its neutral position. so several conditions must be met before a tendon transfer has the potential to correct a dynamic deformity. If the target joint cannot be passively corrected to neutral, it indicates that a static joint contracture or bony deformity exists that cannot be corrected with a dynamic tendon transfer. While in-phase muscles are best, out-of-phase muscles are often the only muscles available for transfer. Tendon transfer should pull in a straight line to avoid tethering and late failure. That's all for this review about tendon transfer principles. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website while going through the topic. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.